KEPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Okay, so this is from the John Dos Passos, The Big Money, part of the USA trilogy, written in 1937. It's a kind of an addendum to each chapter. This one's the Camera I 50. And it's about Sacco and Vanzetti, but it still applies to this day. And it's amazing how the struggle back in the 20s and 30s is the same struggle we're having now. They have clubbed us off the streets. They are stronger. They are rich. They hire and fire the politicians, the newspaper editors, the old judges, the small men with reputations, the college presidents, the ward healers. Listen, businessmen, college presidents, judges, America will not forget her betrayers. They hire the men with guns, the uniforms, the police cars, the patrol wagons. All right, you have won. You will kill the brave men, our friends tonight. There is nothing left to do. We are beaten. We, the beaten crowd, together in these old, dingy schoolrooms on Salem Street, shuffle up and down the gritty, creaking stairs, sit hunched with bowed heads on benches, and hear the old words of the haters of oppression, made new in sweat and agony tonight. Our work is over. The scribbled phrases, the night's typing releases, the smell of the print shop, the sharp reek of new printed leaflets, the rush for Western Union stringing words into wires, the search for stinging words to make you feel, who are your oppressors, America? America, our nation, has been beaten by strangers who have turned our language inside out, who have taken the clean words our fathers spoke and made them slimy and foul. Their hired men sit on the judge's bench. They sit back with their feet on the tables under the dome of the state house. They are ignorant of our beliefs. They have the dollars, the guns, the armed forces, the power plants. They have built the electric chair and hired the executioner to throw the switch. All right, we are two nations. America, our nation has been beaten by strangers who have bought the laws and fenced off the meadows and cut down the woods for pulp and turned our pleasant cities into slums and sweated the wealth out of our people. And when they want to, they hire the executioner to throw the switch. But do they know that the old words of the immigrants are being renewed in blood and agony tonight? Do they know that the old American speech of the haters of oppression is new tonight in the mouth of an old woman from Pittsburgh, of a husky boilermaker from Frisco, who hopped freights clear from the coast to come here, in the mouth of a Black Bay social worker, in the mouth of an Italian printer, of a hobo from Arkansas? The language of the beaten nation is not forgotten in our ears tonight. The men in the death house made the old words new before they died. If it had not been for these things, I might have lived out my life talking at street corners to scorning men. I might have died unknown, unmarked, a failure. This is our career and our triumph. Never in our full life can we hope to do such work for tolerance, for justice, for man's understanding of man, as now we do by an accident. Now their work is over. The immigrants, haters of oppression, lie quiet in black suits in the little undertaking parlor in the North End. The city is quiet. The men of the conquering nation are not to be seen on the streets. They have won. Why are they scared to be seen on the streets? On the streets you see only the downcast faces of the beaten. The streets belong to the beaten nation all the way to the cemetery where the bodies of the immigrants are to be burned. We line the curbs in the drizzling rain, we crowd the wet sidewalks elbow to elbow, silent, pale, looking with scared eyes at the coffins. We stand defeated, America. So there's two things that I take from this. One is the other story that I read, the reason I got into John Dos Passos is the Centralia Massacre was up there right across the border of Washington. The mill, depending on who you talk to, there was a strike at the mill, and the American Legion thought strikers were communists. So they killed, on Armistice Day, they killed several strikers, some of whom were veterans, claiming that they are communists. Yeah, and I've noticed that first of all, every time we start winning, like the Battle of Seattle, we were winning after Iran-Contra, we were winning right before the Ukraine War, all of a sudden, there's a war. and ruins all, and just ruins the movement. And the way it ruins the movement is they use labor against social justice, saying that social justice movements are communists. And this is my own observation. Please use your own brain at all times. You know, Marx was in the United States during the Civil War and wrote a book about the Civil War. The movement is in all countries. There is no communist conspiracy from Russia. The Russian Revolution, we had at the American Revolution, we threw out the monarchs. In the Russian Revolution, they threw out the monarchs. It's not communism. What people are calling communism are social justice movements just demanding fair wages and environmental protection. And that turns into communism. And then, just like in the Chehalis massacre, they used the American Legion to fight the strikers. And during some accounts say that they actually castrated the head of the strikers. And I just want to say, you know, what kind of, this is my own observation, is that nothing wrong with homosexuality, but is that some kind of latent homosexuality where you hold someone down and castrate them and then hang them from a bridge? What type of latent suppressed homosexuality is that? I mean, can't you just watch pro sports like everybody else? So anyway, yeah, the problems we're having today, it's the same struggle we've had all along, and you need to unite with other people against the common problem, which is corporations and their elite owners. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Coming up, the second part of Martin Luther King, Poor People's Campaign by Roots Action.
The belief in the power of people around the world freeing themselves, that capacity of people to free themselves. And I think that this helped, it grounded his opposition to US militarism, because US militarism is presented as a solution to the world's problems. But King, like all internationalists, saw that the people of the world are capable of solving their own problems through their heroic resistance and an amazing time of resistance that he was living in. So as the people of Ukraine endure and survive and resist, and as the people of Palestine resist a new round of Israeli violence, as the people of Iran fight for freedom, we would do well to not only challenge the militarism of the US government, even when that militarism is popular, perhaps especially when that militarism is popular, do we need to challenge it. But we would also do well to take a page from Dr. King's book and engage and learn with the freedom fighters of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Corey, for that beautiful, beautiful remark. Oftentimes when we talk about nuclear weapons, we talk about billions of dollars that are invested in renewing and modernizing. And I often wonder how much of that could be spent on social programs here at home, which brings me great pleasure to bring our next guest, because she is continuing to fight for the people of Buffalo, for people to benefit and take advantage from those social programs. India Walton, who's also another wonderful colleague of mine, is a native Buffalonian and former Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo. After a decade-long career as a registered nurse working at Children and Hospital and Buffalo Public Schools, India decided to devote her life to systemic change in the pursuit of justice and equity for all humans. India worked as a community organizer advocating for everything from police accountability to fair housing and food justice. In 2017, India co-founded and eventually served as the executive director of the Fruit Belt Community Land Trust, Buffalo's first democratically run affordable housing organization. Currently, India serves as the strategic director of Roots Action Civic Education, which she co-created with the Roots Action Education Fund to advance equity and civic engagement in Buffalo, New York. Welcome, India, and please take it away.
Thank you, Hanya. It is such an honor to be here this evening and to speak. I really am appreciating all of the education and wisdom that I'm hearing from the other panelists. As we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. today and all of this week coming with kind words about nonviolence and about dreams of a more just society, I embody and I carry with me a dream deferred. My name is Indy Walton and I hail from Buffalo, New York, stolen land from the Haudenosaunee indigenous people in this region. Today, I want to focus on the triple pronged evils. I know many of you have maybe been watching the national news about some of the tragedies that have struck Buffalo, New York within the last year. We had a racist massacre where we lost 10 innocent lives in a grocery store on the east side of Buffalo, which is predominantly Black, that has been plagued for generations with concentrated poverty, disadvantage. It is a place where their, you know, mainstream folks might call it a food desert. But locally, we call it food apartheid because we know that these are policy decisions that allowed a person who wanted to identify and murder Black folks knew exactly where to find them. And that was the single grocery store within a 3-mile radius in a neighborhood that is predominantly Black and brown. You know, couple that with a recent snowstorm where we lost 40 people in Erie County who died as a result of a blizzard, and more than half of those people look like me. They were Black people on the east side, and that is a basic lack of not only leadership, but infrastructure of safe, affordable housing. And I really appreciate that everyone is focused on anti-militarism from an international and a war standpoint. But I want to talk about the three-pronged evils of racism, of excessive materialism, AKA capitalism, and of excessive militarism. And when we talk about militarism, that can also translate into how we treat our municipal police forces. We have a police force that in Buffalo, like in many other cities across this nation, we are expecting them to take care of every single societal ill that is a result of austerity budgeting and cutting social services and social safety nets. What we saw during the Christmas blizzard, where we had children, elderly, houseless people, and our most vulnerable die in the cold, I mean, people being found frozen in snowbanks. What we saw was that our mayor decided to put our police department, who are equipped with AR-15s, who are equipped with anti-public gathering equipment, but nothing to rescue folks from a snow emergency, they were detailed to stop looting. And when I hear someone say looting, what I hear is there are people who are desperate, who have been denied basic necessities, who are just trying to survive. Our police department was empowered, equipped, and is hyper-militarized to find petty thieves before they would answer 911 calls that were backlogged, more than 1,000 people who were looking to check on loved ones and who were calling for help. So we can find people who were finding toilet paper and diapers and baby formula and milk and water in a warm place to be so they didn't freeze to death. We are costing them and arresting them and ticketing people rather than using resources that were desperately needed to go and rescue people who actually needed help. Buffalo is a place of great tragedy, but also of great hope. And what I want to carry with me into this next year as we move forward, as I remember the spirit of Dr. King and so many others, is a spirit of radical truth, of radical love, of radical care, And in the words of our great sage, Mr. Tupac Shakur, they got money for wars, but can't feed the poor. And I think that right now, today, we have to commit ourselves to reclaiming our humanity, to saying no to militarism, to saying no to war, and saying yes to one another, saying yes to community, and building the communities of care and the mutual aid that we know is allowing our communities to survive. That has been the thing that has kept us together, and also translating that into electoral and legislative power so that we can ensure that we are not catering to the wealthy and the warmongers, but that we are catering to the people, to the workers and the families and the folks who are caring and keeping our communities surviving. So thank you very much for having me, and I'm looking forward to enjoying the rest of the program.
Thank you so much, India. Just recently, Los Angeles saw an incredible amount of rain, unfortunately. I'm just looking at, you know, just to kind of tie it to what you were talking about, the police board of the police commission has supported an increase of $119 million of the LAPD's budget for the fiscal year 2023-2024, which will then bring the total general fund budget to $2 billion. And during the rain, we did not have adequate shelter for the homeless in Los Angeles, California, one of the top, richest economies in the world, right? Pastor Mike McBride, do we have you on? Oh yeah, there you are. Wonderful. We do have Pastor Michael McBride with us, who is going to be our next speaker. Pastor Mike is a native of San Francisco and has been active in ministry for over 20 years. Pastor McBride's commitment to holistic ministry can be seen through his leadership role in both the church and the community organizations. He's a graduate of Duke University's Divinity School with a Master in Divinity with an emphasis in ethics and public policy. Pastor McBride founded the Way Christian Center in West Berkeley, where he presently serves as the lead pastor. Pastor Mike, you have the floor.
Well, it's great to be here with everyone, and grace and peace to all my colleagues and comrades. Many faces I recognize and see on this call, people who obviously lived their lives as students of Dr. King and his philosophy of nonviolence and peacemaking. And so I'm sure much of what I would say and hope to say has been said in much more eloquence than I would love to expand on our beloved India Walton's comments about the connections between our domestic policy and the international sensibilities of using violence and war as a way to achieve peace. I do think one of our greatest tasks as organizers and as prophets and speakers and thought leaders and faith leaders and elected leaders is to help make the connection to everyday citizens of this country that we can't achieve peace without having to rely on forms of violence. The idea that we are still relying on what I often call sanctioned violence or legalized violence through law enforcement, through the militarized apparatuses of our country, the fact that we are so dependent on the gun in this country to imagine what protection and safety looks like, it does create, I think, a predisposition for too many voters in our society to then find it totally within the bounds of reason to depend on such violence in another context. It is indeed the case that if we, the United States of America, cannot figure out ways to solve our own domestic problems with all the wealth, all the education, all of the resources at our disposal, if we can't figure out ways to address violence here in this context, it becomes a bridge too far to expect our voters and our policymakers to then look at countries much less resourced than ours to believe then that they can figure out ways to solve their conflicts without violence. It then creates a seed in the mind of the average American voter, whether they are a faith person of faith, whether they are of no faith, whether they find themselves on the Republican, independent, Democratic spectrum, that if we can't see nonviolent approaches to solving problems here, then how can we even imagine in other countries where they don't have the kind of quote unquote stability or resources, can they solve problems in their context without violence? And then we find ourselves willing to continue to fund and scale up violence and uphold what Dr. King said, that we are still, as the American government, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. This becomes, I think, a moral crisis for us, but it's also a crisis of just governance, of us being able in cities to elect city council members and mayors, of us in states to be able to elect legislature and governors, of us at the federal level to elect Congress members and, dare I even say, presidents, who are not throwing lip service towards the kinds of alternative to sanctioned violence in our communities, when we know that with public health interventions, with a robust investment in food programs, housing programs, purposeful vocational programs, restorative justice programs, on and on and on, that a radical investment of that here can help shift the imagination of the average voter when we think of abroad, right? You know, I'm growing up in the Pentecostal tradition, and my father loved the proof text scriptures all growing up. And so I love one of these passages where he just pulled it out and said, charity begins at home and then is spread abroad. We must, I believe, continue to bring back alive a domestic movement of peacemaking that has relevance in cities across the country, in neighborhoods across the country. Only then, I believe, can we start to help people's imagination around how this then is spread abroad become a reality. And it is not, to me, either or. We all know, or I hope we continue to hold this idea that the surplus militarized vehicles and equipment of the Department of Defense too often find themselves on the American urban street corner because they have to use those surplus vehicles somewhere. So there is a direct connection in this regard, but I am hopeful that we can continue to push ourselves to call on mayors and governors and presidents, city council members, state legislatures, and the Congress to not just throw pennies at community violence intervention strategies or peacemaking intervention strategies, but to make sure it's proportional investment. Right now, the Biden administration has put, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in their upcoming budget to fund, you know, non-law enforcement, non-carceral interventions to violence. But then at the same time, they committed $1 trillion over the next 10 years to keep funding police. And so, you know, my argument is don't tip the, you know, nonviolence responses to, you know, public safety and then continue to pay the full bill that we already are spending on the kinds of state violence that we know is a problem. And so we must, I believe, continue to raise our voice. I don't take it for granted that Dr. King's internationalism was deeply informed by the depths of his organizing all across the country, by this idea that he was organizing in a context, an ecosystem, where there was a deep, powerful anti-war movement in this country. I find it so important for us. We may not have to call it anti-war, but we should have a deep, robust peacemaking movement in this country that makes it virtually impossible for someone to be elected to the government without at least listening and making commitments to a peacemaking ethic. It's impossible for someone to pastor a congregation or be an imam or be a rabbi or be an atheist and find yourself described as a moral individual and not have a peacemaking ethic rolling off of your lips with deep nuance and deep passion. I pray and I hope these can be our commitments. I pray as Dr. King's birthday comes upon us again, we reclaim the radical voice of Dr. King, as Dr. Cornel West often says, that we reject the Kool-Aid Dr. King that can easily be quoted out of context. You can quote Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech out of context, but you can't quote Dr. King's Vietnam speech out of context, right? So how do we make sure we bring the vision, the moral vision of this individual and his legacy to bear in this moment in time? I literally believe our lives, our children's lives, dare I say the fate of this country, it hinges on the capacity and the ability of we, the people of this United States, to eschew violence and to embrace peacemaking. Always great to be here with you all, and I look forward to the furthering of this conversation.
Thank you, Pastor McBride, for joining us tonight, your words of wisdom, your prayer. And at the end of this call, I urge everyone to stick around because we do have a call to action and a campaign that we have organized around nuclear disarmament, which will be shared with you by my esteemed colleague, Ryan Black, who will be joining us shortly. But what a great way to segue into our next speaker's segment, the good Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, who is the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival with the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber. She is the director of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. Liz is the editor of the We Cry Justice, Reading the Bible with the Poor People's Campaign. She is the author of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor, and co-author of Revive Us Again, Visions and Actions in Moral Organizing. She is also the ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, USA. Dr. Theo Harris, please take it away. What an honor to be here with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's amazing to be in this cloud of beautiful witnesses. I was raised in a family that was dedicated to peace and justice and nuclear disarmament, racial and economic justice, global cooperation. So I feel right at home this evening. As we gather to honor Reverend Dr. King, I believe we actually have to catch up with him so then we can kind of carry on that work. As we've already heard, this evening, Reverend Dr. King clearly saw that a foreign policy defined by racism, poverty, and militarism hurt the poor and dispossessed across the planet as it drained the moral virality of the United States and the resources needed to fight poverty and injustice at home. So we know that famous phrase from Dr. King's sermon, A Year to the Day That He Was Assassinated, where he warned that a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And I think all of us here this evening would agree that he was right. A violence-first approach to foreign and domestic policy doesn't address the root causes of conflict or unrest. It doesn't make the people of the United States any safer, and it certainly doesn't make the rest of the world safer. Every dollar spent on feeding this war machine is a dollar not spent on housing, not spent on healthcare or education, not spent on jobs or preventing pandemics or confronting the climate crisis. And so in a country with 140 million people who are poor and low income, beset with searing poverty, gapping inequality, widespread environmental injustice, this overblown Pentagon budget that comes year after year is not just a case of mismatched priorities, I would assert. It's actually a war on the poor. The poor of the US and the poor of the world. Now, nearly half of the money, as I think folks here probably are aware, that flows into the Pentagon's overstuffed coffers goes straight directly to for-profit war corporations. Corporations like Lockheed Martin, whose multi-million dollar lobbying spending is only matched by its excessive salaries of their top executives, right? And as we heard about what was happening in Buffalo and what we know is happening across California and other places, the modern system of policing used to suppress Black, Brown, and poor communities in order to protect private property and preserve kind of the existing hierarchy of poverty is very similar and parallel to this war economy, both in the US and across the world. And again, I want to point out, and I think we all know this, but I think it can never be said too much, this is in the richest country in the world, a country where nearly half of the population is poor or one couple hundred dollar emergency from absolute economic.
On KEPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Tell your friends.
Macron, where there are 87 million uninsured and underinsured people, where tens of millions of people have lost their health insurance in the worst public health crisis in generations, where tens of millions of workers make less than a living wage, have a new title where they're called essential, but are treated as expendable, where 15 million families can't afford water, where 4 million families have water that is poisoned, where 10 million people are homeless. And although the US doesn't have a military draft, we do have a poverty draft, where many young people have no potential of getting an education or stable employment without joining the military, and so therefore have to and do so. And you have this cruel manipulation of the poor that Dr. King talked about, where poor people, especially Black and Brown people in the United States, are sent to kill poor people, especially people of color across the world. Now, what we also know is the climate crisis is real, and that thousands of communities contaminated by petrochemical companies, industrial waste, and raw sewage are all made worse by the climate crisis, but also the kind of militarization of those communities and the destruction of those communities and the earth all wrapped up in one. And yet, year after year, we hear the same political narrative trumpeted by both parties in the United States that we just don't have enough to provide for everyone. Right. With this kind of scarcity argument has undergirded every federal budget in recent history. But it has to fall flat when we look at the 54 cents of every dollar of federal discretionary dollar that goes to the Pentagon, the trillions of dollars that are being squandered in these never-ending war on terror, not to speak of the kind of unprecedented financial gains the wealthiest have made, as the rest of us suffer from inflation, low-wage jobs, cuts to education, and more. And then when we look at this most recent budget package, we see healthcare and education on the chopping block, but the military-industrial complex is continuing to grow, often more than what is requested in those military budgets. And so we have to ask this question, has our nation actually already reached a kind of spiritual death? Then not to mention what is going to happen over the next 2 years of this House of Representatives as it attacks Medicare and Social Security and any other governmental program that lifts up the people. But as we've also discussed this evening, it's not just the spending on war that is the problem. Dr. King reminds us that war and conflict cause death, division, and devastation in their very nature. And when we're talking about nuclear war, we're talking about a whole other level of devastation. We're talking annihilation. We're talking the destruction of all life. And so I think of this quote by a mentor of mine from when I was a kid, William Stone Kaufman, who said, "Only God has the right to destroy all life on the planet. All we have is the power. We haven't the authority. Therefore, to threaten, to use nuclear weapons must be an abomination in the sight of God." And I think about this idea that we don't have a morality or a right to actually destroy, but we do actually have the possibility of destroying all life on this earth. But you know what? It doesn't have to be this way, right? It just doesn't have to be this way. Things can change, things have changed, things are gonna change. If we were to shrink the US war economy, eliminating nuclear weapons altogether, you know, cutting, at least halving the US military bases in countries all over the world. And if we had fair taxation for the rich and corporations, if we canceled debts and invested in things like universal health care and living wages and a guaranteed income and decent and affordable housing, strong programs of social uplift for the poor, we actually could turn our war economy into, as Code Pink teaches us, a peace economy, right? That this is within reach. This is possible. We know how to do it. It costs more to have this society the way it's organized than it would be to change it and to make it better. And so my call to action this evening, that's connected to the one that folks are doing, you know, throughout this evening, is that we have to build a movement from the bottom up that can reconstruct this nation. And we have to build the kind of compelling power to make those in power have to agree to our demands for peace and truth and love and freedom. And that we have a saying in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, that when we lift from the bottom, everybody rises. That's what we have to be about. And that's what we can be about. And so let us move forward together in that one step back.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. Theo Harris. Hopefully once we're done here, we will send a mass email to everyone with every speaker's organization, and Dr. Theo Harris's organization will be one of the ones that you will be getting the information for, so you can join her and sign on to you know, what she continues to promote, which is justice and peace. It is an honor to have you here, Dr. Theo Harris, and thank you for all the work that you do. Well, it is time for me to introduce someone who I absolutely adore from the bottom of my heart, a progressive champion whom I've had the honor and the privilege of working with on her two congressional campaigns, Senator Nina Turner, who is a hell-raising humanitarian and a tireless advocate for progressive values and social justice. She made history in 2005 and 2008 as the first woman and African-American woman, respectively, to represent those districts. She promoted progressive policies through her work with the Ohio Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, in 2016 and 2020's presidential campaigns and during her time at Our Revolution. Senator Turner is a former assistant professor of history at Cuyahoga Community College and the host of Hello Somebody podcast. She is currently the host and executive producer of Unbossed, a show that airs daily on the Young Turks Network. My sister, please take it away.
Thank you, Hanya. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone. And one of the privileges on being on a panel like this, everything that I would have said has been said. I mean, everybody has been truly magnificent, and I'm seeing people either by name or by face that I haven't had a chance to fellowship with in a very long time. I'm honored to be one of the soldiers on the battlefield with each and every one of you, a battlefield of peace. And maybe that might seem contradictory, but we have got to get as not just committed, but just to be really out there as much as the other side is. I mean, I could quote each and every one of you, but things that are sticking with me right now, what Reverend Theo Harris just said about this budget, which was in my notes too, and it just does boggle my mind. Sister India brought up what the urban poet Tupac said about money for war can't feed the poor, that is timeless. It just reminds me of how when I was on the floor of the Senate, and I'm quoting the founders and also Tupac at the same time, just dazzled them. They just couldn't believe it. Yeah, because I do this thing a whole different way. The knowledge and vision comes from many places and spaces and not just people with special titles. What is done in our name matters. I saw in the chat a question, you know, if they're using taxpayers' dollars to pay for war, are we, you know, is that basically about us? And I kind of pondered that just a little while. What they do in our name matters, and they are the policymakers, and particularly on the federal level. But there is indeed, as Reverend McBride laid out, as Corey laid out, and so many others, there is a link between what we do internationally and what we do domestically. I just had the opportunity to be in New Orleans with a group of some of the best economists in this country. And one of the things, you know, being a senior fellow at the Institute on Race, Power and political economy, to have economists talking about how we can create a moral political economy. Well, we're having that conversation tonight about what it is going to take to create a moral political economy. Part of that is understanding that we cannot spend all of our money in war making. $858 billion budget, and that doesn't count at all. And I think it was Reverend Theo Harris who laid out the fact that they gave the president this time in his budget more than what he even asked for, and that all each and every one of these presidents, and you have a Congress in a bipartisan way, they cannot renew the child tax credit, but bipartisanly they can increase the Pentagon budget. There is something immoral about this, and we have to call it what it is. And to see so many faith leaders, we need faith leaders on the freedom fighting progressive left to have as much chutzpah as the evangelicals have on the right. Because what would Jesus do? Not this foolishness and folly that these folks are doing in our name. What they do in our name matters. Brother Corey brought up the letter to the Birmingham jail, and I had right in front of me Reverend McBride, which I read every single year about this time, is Dr. Cornel West's The Radical King. See, like Reverend McBride said, you know, they can sit up there and mess around with the I Have a Dream speech, but what you cannot do is wrongly critique what Dr. King had to say about militarism, poverty, racism, and materialism. So you can't get that one twisted. And so what we're going to find on the MLK holiday is what we do find about this time every single year is politicians on both sides of the aisle quoting Dr. King, but wouldn't understand what Dr. King was standing for if it smacked them in the face. It is bigger than quoting him on the King holiday. It is what you do in the people's name with the people's money, whether it's domestically or internationally. Now, while I do support what this country is doing by and large to be in fellowship, and I'm using that term lightly, with our sisters and brothers of the Ukraine. There are innocent Ukrainians dying, there are innocent Russians dying, there are innocent people all across this world dying. But for every dollar that is spent in the Ukraine or any other war-making activity, they should be spending $5 right here domestically. It is a sin and a shame to have so many people in a hegemonic nation like the United States of America go to bed hungry every single night. It is a sin and a shame that this Congress could not come together in a bipartisan way to expand and make permanent the child tax credit. But meanwhile, in the hoods where people are misunderstood, and I'm talking about the rural hoods, the urban hoods, and the suburban hoods, people have to grovel just to get a modicum of what it means to have a quality of life. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would be mortified, and we all know it, and all like 250 of our family and friends who are on this call with us today, we all have a role to play in peacemaking. Norman, you may remember when Congressman Dennis Kucinich had pondered a Department of Peace. I'm old enough to remember, and they laughed at him. They thought he was making a mockery. Thank you.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his coke from Columbia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid. His lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member. Or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.